Well, thanks so much for inviting me here to talk today. I want to give you a little bit of historical context in my background to give you some sense of where I'm coming from. I started off as a tropical evolutionary biologist, and so I started off working on questions like how many species are there on Earth, where do we find them, why are there more species in some places rather than others, and I found myself recently in this strange modern circumstance that I'm spending more time thinking about colons than rainforests, and so I'm going to walk you through how that ended up being the case. My first book was Every Living Thing, and it was about biological discovery in general, and this is sort of what led me down this road. And this book came about in part because I looked around at my colleagues and I realized that many of my colleagues worked on super interesting things that they loved, that they found great joy in, and there were things that most people didn't know anything about. And so one of my colleagues was a longshoreman who became a biologist, a great big tough kind of mean guy, and he worked on fish ovaries. And if he talked about most things, he is not a very likable person, but if he was talking about fish ovaries, he was incredibly captivating and charismatic. And so sharing these stories of the ways that ordinary folks lay hold of what we do and don't know about biology became really interesting to me. And I was interested both in the general sense and the historical sense. And so many of you might know this guy up here, Linnaeus. He turns out to be a character not so unlike my colleague with the fish ovaries. He was a super strange guy. And we know him mostly for giving us the system we use to name species. But he was also an ambitious guy. He wanted to describe all of the species on Earth. And so there was one point in his career when Linnaeus and all of his students, who he called apostles, which I think has, we don't call them apostles now, but maybe sometimes we think of them that way. He thought he and his students would name every single species and that it would be about 7,000 species on all of Earth. For context, there are now 12,000 bird species alone. So we didn't quite get it. But remember that number 7,000, because I'm going to come back to it. And so I wrote about Linnaeus, but I also wrote about this guy who's a colleague of mine. His name's Terry Irwin. And Irwin, when he was working in the 1980s in tropical forests, he went to a bar and he started thinking about how many species there might be in all of the forests in the world, how many species there might be in all of the world. It's the kind of thing you think about at a bar if you're a biologist. And so he thought that maybe there were 100 million species on Earth. Now, for context, at this point in history, most people thought there were about 2 million. And so Terry at the bar had essentially imagined 98 million new species. And so what happened after Terry did that was that my colleagues, said that he was full of it. This can't possibly be right. And so there was this debate that lasted about 2 years. And I find this whole story fascinating for many reasons, but one of the most interesting aspects is that debate died. No one debates this question anymore, because the consensus was sort of that we know so little about the species on Earth in general that nobody can distinguish between the 100 million and the 2 million possibility. We're still too ignorant to draw the bar any finer. And so that's where I started, thinking about these kinds of questions and thinking about the other reality. Let me get out of the way of my light here. But even once we know these species, we typically don't know very much about them. Anybody know these critters? These are ambrosia beetles. They're outside right now. They're teeny tiny, and they have little pockets like armpits in which they carry fungus. They carry that fungus to dead trees, and when they get to those trees, they plant the fungus, which they then garden, and that's what their babies eat. Most species of these beetles on Earth are not named. Some of these species are beneficial decomposers. Another one you might have heard of is the coffee bearer borer, which is the single biggest threat to coffee in the world. It was not named as of several years ago and probably is several species. But the interesting thing here is that these species are not just individual species. They're actually consortia of species. Take away their fungus and they don't exist. Take away their bacteria and they don't exist. And so this was the interesting other part to the story. As you look around in ecology, evolution in general, most species are not just unknown in and of themselves, but also in terms of who they interact with. These are nasute termites. This is a giant schnoz that they shoot turpentine out of as a defense against ants. So really cool adaptation. The hard part about this is so big that their mouths have become teeny tiny and they can't feed on their own anymore. And so their sisters and brothers have to feed them. But the other thing that helps them feed are these critters, microbes in their guts. And in fact, they have nitrogen-fixing bacteria in their guts that essentially take nitrogen out of the air and make it food. 70% of the nitrogen in their body comes directly from the air. And so they're essentially eating air. And so almost every species you look at in terms of insects or other vertebrates has stories like this. And so on the one hand, we don't know about life in general. On the other hand, every time we look at some species in detail, it's a web of interactions. And so it was in this context that I got interested in humans and thinking about our interactions. So how many species would you guess are on your body right now? Just shout it out. 1,000? 100? I heard 1,000, 100. No, nobody can tell you, right? My guess would be that we have in the order of 2,000 to 5,000 bacteria species. Nobody can tell you about the bacteriophages. We have all kinds of animals. And that's just the things living on our body. And so I would argue we have the same kinds of interactions, but they spread out not just to include things like our bacteria, but also predators and all of these species we've interacted with over time. And so that's what I'm going to talk to you about today in the context of the story of my book, but also in the context of the work we're doing in my lab. And so if you want to sort of ignore the talk and go about your eating, this is my thesis. That tens of thousands of other species affect our health and well-being, most of them without names, that they can do so by being present or by being absent, and they do so as a function of their presence, our genes, and their genes. And that this is happening to you right now. If the person next to you smells funny, that's the responsibility of the mix of their genes and their microbes, right? And so almost everything about us is influenced by these interactions. I'm going to start in a funny place with this in thinking about our predators. Has anybody here ever been eaten by a predator? Right, so not me either. We don't think about predators. We don't think about them in the context of health and well-being. Very rarely do people come to hospitals with problems due to predators. And when we think about them in the context of our own story, we think about something like this. We were the tough ones with weapons, and that's why we get to eat other species for lunch at a nice table. What I think a really interesting thing to think about in this context is that for most of our evolutionary history, we looked more like this critter. This is an early primate. And the important thing here is that this critter was the size of a Big Mac. And so if we think about this evolutionary history, there are lots of ways in which we might have been influenced by predators. And I would argue that we have been, even when they're absent. And so when people look at this picture, you have a pretty visceral response to the big snake. Maybe a more visceral one to this one. And it's been argued plausibly that there's an evolutionary legacy of dying because of venomous snakes and actually being eaten by big constrictors. There's an indigenous group in the Philippines that even today, one of the main threats to adult males is dying because of python death. And if we look at infants, if we look at preverbal infants and we show them a picture of a hippo or of a snake, the preverbal infant will look at the two pictures about the same amount of time. If a parent speaks in a fearful voice while they're looking, they focus on the snake. And so a fair amount of evidence for influence of these kinds of species, even if they're absent. None of us think about being eaten by eagles, but maybe our ancestors were. Lots of primates today are. And then there's this really interesting hominid fossil skull. This is the Tang child, very important in terms of thinking about our evolutionary tree. It's also important because these are talon holes. Not the Wright brothers, but in fact, this little dude was the first in flight. And so we have lots of kinds of species that potentially impacted us in terms of predation. This is a species that we deal with today in lots of parts of the world. I think that the caption here is self-explanatory. You might think that we're now big enough that we're not at risk, or at least historically we weren't at risk from those sorts of predation events. This is a gorilla toe and a leopard scat. And so predators influenced us, all even really big ones. And even things we don't tend to think about. This is a new crocodile species that's named the man-eating crocodile because it was found next to two hominid skeletons missing parts of their legs. But the thing that you might be thinking is we killed off most of these things. We don't live with predators in our daily lives. And so that's an old story. But I would argue it actually influences us in many ways today. So I won't scream right now. But if I did, many of you would have an immediate fight or flight response to the potential threat. What's that? That's mediated by our amygdala. It's an ancient response to predation and to fear. Our screams themselves are pre-verbal utterances that have to do with danger. And then we have things like our goosebumps. What do our goosebumps do? Functionally nothing. They make us look like stupid kind of hairless chickens, right? But historically, our goosebumps are teeny tiny muscles making hair straighten up so that we look scary in light of a predation event or in light of some kind of interaction. The specifics of our vision, the fact that we have trichromatic vision, the only two plausible arguments for the origin of our trichromatic vision is that it relates to finding fruits or that it relates to finding snakes. And so these are pretty fundamental things. Nighttime births. If you look at when labor begins in humans, without induction, it tends to be in the middle of the night. In a medical context, that's a problem. But evolutionarily, that's kind of interesting. Well, the primate biologists in studying this have concluded that in non-human primates, nighttime births have to do with giving birth during safe times of day. If that were true, what you would expect is that nocturnal primates give birth during the day. They do. And so there are these evolutionary pieces to our stories. I couldn't get this link to work, but one of the most interesting ones has to do with the origin of language. If you look at the utterances that other primates have, most of those utterances that convey specific meaning have to do with predators. And so vervet monkeys can say, oh no snake, oh no eagle, and oh no big cat. They don't say it like that, but there's a plausible argument about the birth of language being related to predation. And predation is just one of the kinds of interactions we deal with. We also have parasites, things like toxoplasmosis that I'm sure many of you have dealt with or think about. Toxoplasmosis, from an evolutionary perspective, is this really interesting story. In as much as Toxoplasma gondii, in order to reproduce, has to get into a cat. It cannot reproduce without being inside some kind of feline. And so it's evolved really interesting adaptations to manipulate the behavior of the mice it starts off in. It makes mice less scared, less afraid of novelty, less vigilant of predators, attracted to the smell of cat pee, and ultimately more likely to be eaten by a cat. It looks like what's happening is that the parasite's actually producing precursors to dopamine in the brain. And so this is a cool evolutionary story about parasites. It's the kind of story that as an evolutionary biologist we think about all the time. This is a fungus that takes over the brains of ants. It makes them climb up to really high things. It then grows up out of their head and disperses through the forest. It's a relative of this fungus that produces cyclosporine, which many of you may know. Cyclosporine's origins probably have to do with manipulating the immune system of insects. But it turns out that there's actually an interesting human component to toxoplasma as well. There's one that you might think of, which is this effect on the fetus, and is the reason we tell pregnant mothers not to deal with cat feces. But the other way that toxoplasma gets into us is by eating incompletely cooked meat. And so it's plausible that we might actually, in the context of our ancient predation, think of ourselves as an intermediate host for toxoplasma. That in the context of modern life, toxoplasma never gets a chance to reproduce because we don't get eaten by big cats. But maybe historically, we did. Now this is sort of a circus performer thing. This seems silly, except that Joanna Webster and other folks have now shown that in individuals who show infection from Toxoplasma gondii, they have increased activity, decreased reaction times, and altered personality profiles. They're 2.5 times more likely to be in car accidents. And right now, Toxoplasma gondii is the single best predictor of the onset of schizophrenia. And so these are big things. Again, you might think these are big things but relevant to other people. If you happen to be French, they're very relevant. So I don't know who this is. This is what happens when you Google two French guys. In France, 80% of people show evidence of having been exposed to Toxoplasma gondii. And so to the extent this parasite is affecting our behavior, it could also explain the French. So far, these are actually species we don't think about as being good for us, and yet they still have potential impacts on who we are and how we are. I want to move on to thinking a little bit about species we think of as beneficial or mutualists. Things like honeybees, microbes, and even cows. Historically, when we thought about cows and we thought about milk, we thought about milk as being this kind of superfood, this food that everybody should get. And if you couldn't digest milk as an adult, you were somehow degenerate. It was a dysfunction, a disease state, a problem that needed curing. And this made sense in the early context because, after all mammals drink milk. If you can't drink milk, you have a problem. But the truth that everybody seemed to ignore early in the story was all mammals drink milk, but only as babies. In fact, it looks as though we're the only mammal that drinks milk as an adult. And so the weird part of the story is not being able to drink milk. The weird part of the story is we can drink milk. And so people started to think in the 1960s about what was going on with milk. Why can some of us digest it, but why can't most people on Earth digest milk as an adult? And so what came to be argued relatively recently was that those peoples who were associated with cows and with the domestication of cows and with milk, that they actually had adaptations for dealing with milk as adults because it provided clean drinking liquid and it provided sustenance. And so what you might expect is that the geography of where people can drink milk should match that story. In fact, in Europe it seems to. So the redder an area is, the more people can drink milk. And in fact, if you look at the genes for lactase persistence, they seem to be associated with European milk drinkers. And that was the end of the story for a while. And it just persisted in the literature like that. Oops. And nobody seemed to notice that, in fact, all over Africa, other people who clearly were not of the same lineage also drank huge quantities of milk. And so what was going on? It now looks as though the genes for lactase persistence have actually, new variants have evolved no fewer than 5 times independently in association with tending cows. And so here's this really interesting story that's kind of a different sort, because it suggests not just our intimate relationship with other species, but that different human lineages have different relationships with other species that affect how our health and well-being. And so depending who your ancestors were, will strongly affect which nutrients you get out of the food you're eating right now. And so these ancient stories actually have very modern aspects. And it's not just milk. The more we look, the more we see these stories. So amylase genes, which help us break down starch, and especially in our mouth. The number of copies of amylase genes varies from 0 in some people to 16 in others. And the copy number of amylase genes is associated with differences in the ability to produce amylase. And it looks like those people with more amylase copies appear to be from ancestries in which more starch was consumed. And so there are many of these differences. And some of them are really cool ecological stories that involve lots of species. So this is a cool bacteria that's only been found in some Japanese guts. This bacteria appears to have stolen genes from a marine bacteria species able to break down seaweed. And so it looks like this is the effect of a relationship between Japanese diets, seaweed, and the microbiota that results in these specific adaptations of this bacteria, which almost certainly lead to differences between these Japanese guts and everybody else's guts in terms of what happens when you eat sushi. And so these are very interesting specific stories. And so what they've led me to is to try to think about all these species in general. But one of the problems is that the smaller we get in terms of these species, the less we know. And the more the story of thinking about our bodies bumps up against the story of every living thing, of how little we know in general. And so what we know when we think about our bodies that the species on them and in them do all of these things. They affect our odors. They're our first line of defense against pathogens before the pathogens even hit our immune system. They have key roles in immune development. They affect our behavior, vitamin production. And the vast majority of our genes are the genes of other species on us. And this doesn't really end at our body, it keeps going. But the problem is, I would argue that from the perspective of these species, we're sort of in Linnaeus's time. We think maybe there are 7,000 species, and that's what remains to be named on our bodies. But we don't really know very much about them. And so we're kind of tropical explorers, which would be exciting and quaint, except we're tropical explorers of our own bodies. And so just as one measure of this, we have a project in my lab called the Belly Button Biodiversity Project, in which we've sampled the belly button skin of around 600 people so far, looking for which kinds of species we're finding there and to what extent we can predict which species we find. We find, on average, about 67 species in a single swab from a single belly button. In the first 50 people we sampled, we found 2,000 species. Most of those species do not have names. Several of those species do not relate to known phyla of microbes. Two of the species that were found on almost everybody and common when they were found did not have names. And so we're in this really exploratory phase of thinking about what's there. And so I should say, this is like all the science we do in my lab. It's public science, and so we try to engage the public in every step of it. And so when we do these swabs, we also culture microbes, and people get to see what they had. But the cool thing about both being a writer and a scientist is when I start to write about topics like this, I find big holes we don't know anything about. I get to go back in the lab and actually try to figure some things out. The hard thing is that when we look at our bodies, we're still in this state of looking out at the universe, about this proportion of which we understand. And so that's what I'm going to talk about for the rest of the talk, is what we're finding out about what lives with us. And I'm going to start off by just, in essence, trying to catalog what's around us, how much. And if you want to see more about this or get involved in any of these projects, you can check out yourwildlife.org, which is where we do all our work. We started off really easy by cheating and looking at multicellular species, and so our first project was actually called the School of Ants, in which we got kids to go out and look at ants. We didn't think we'd find big new things with that, but these are all kids who participated. This is an invasive ant we at first found only in Raleigh. An 8-year-old just found it in Washington State. This has a 2 in 100 anaphylactic shock rate when it stings, which is tenfold greater than honeybees. And nobody knew it was even in Washington State. We also found it in Manhattan. Kids found it. And so we're some basic things in the big life category. Oops. I think I hit a dangerous button. Can you get it back up? But we've also tried to figure out, well, how many species actually live in the average home? Just starting with animals. And I thought when we started this that we would find like 20 species in the average house. And my house was one of the first ones sampled, and I was on sabbatical. And I got an email that said, Rob, we found 120 species in your house. And we had a renter, and so I thought the renter had just ruined my house. And it's turned out that we found on the order of 120 animal species in almost everybody's house. And many of these animals don't have names. And many of these animals we know very little about. Anybody know this critter? It's a camel cricket. During this project, we actually sent out an interview to ask people, do you have these in your house? And immediately, 800 people responded, whether they did or didn't. And when we looked at the data, the camel crickets were in weird places, and something seemed wrong. And it turned out what was going on was that not that native species, but this invasive Japanese camel cricket had invaded basement to basement across North America, totally unnoticed. And all we had to do was find it, was ask people to go take a picture in their basement. And so I actually think this is really emblematic of what we're trying to do in general, is the reality is we're so ignorant about our houses that we can find new kinds of animals spreading from one to the next, and that we try to do so while involving the people that live in those houses. So Michelle Troutwain, Michelle's the person, not the centipede, is the one leading this project for us. But we've also gotten bolder and gone to the microbes, and so we've started to survey places like your refrigerator. We've actually surveyed these 9 places in 40 houses in Raleigh and Durham and North Carolina to try to figure out what about the microbial species? How many are we finding and which ones? And I thought when we started this that somebody else must have done this. This turns out this is the biggest study of microbial life in houses, 40 houses. And so we looked at these different habitats. We thought they might be different, but maybe we would also find the same microbes throughout the house. We sent swabs out to people. They sent them back. And this is what we see. So this is the number of kinds of microbes on average in a single swab of these habitats. And so the first thing to notice is that we never, ever don't find microbes. We actually find microbes on antimicrobial wipes. Literally. And typically we find lots of species. So this is 150 species in one swab. And you see differences in the different habitats. These places where stuff settles tend to be a little bit more diverse. But the other interesting thing is that there's a lot of structure in this composition. So let me walk you through this figure, if you're not familiar with this kind of figure. Each point is a sample. Points that are color-coded the same are from the same type of habitat. And so this is door trim. And the closer together two points are, the more similar their species are. And so there are a couple interesting things here. One is we kind of get three main habitats. We get things associated with outside that are coming in. We get things associated with our bodies, and we get things associated with our food. And so that's interesting in and of itself. So the house is very structured. You'll also notice we can't actually tell pillowcases and toilet seats apart microbially. Literally, that's true. We can tell the gender of the toilet seat or the pillowcase because we pick up vaginal bacteria, but we can't tell which one is which. And so that's true in your hotel room, too. I saved this for later in lunch. But the other interesting thing is, can we make some predictions about what accounts for differences among people's houses? Because if you notice, for a given habitat type, there's a lot of variation. This is one door sill, this is somebody else's. And for health and disease, the expectation is that different places on this graph differ in how healthy they are. Some of these houses are more sick than others. Some of the people in these houses are more sick than others. What can we actually see? And so our prediction was that outdoor environments would be really important for houses, the daily ongoings would be important, but also that pets would be important. And so we tested a lot of different things in these first 40 houses. One of them was the presence or absence of a dog. Contrary to my preference, we counted this kind of dog as a dog. But what we found, and this is a pillowcase plot, is that houses with dogs were very different from those without dogs. And so this is for a pillowcase. Points that are closer together are more similar. In essence, we can tell you whether or not you have a dog on the basis of your pillowcase or your TV. Having a dog explains 40% of the variation in the composition of bacteria on your TV screen and pillowcase. This person used to have a dog. I'm not joking, that's literally true. And so we see these two same things for these two kinds of habitats, and in part what's happening is there are a whole suite of microbial lineages that are becoming much more common when people have dogs. Some of these are associated with dogs' mouths. A lot of these are soil species, so Frankia, which is a soil nitrogen-fixing bacteria. It's coming into these houses. It's actually, where's Frankiaceae? It's 800 times more common on the TV screens in dog houses. And so this is a big effect just of having a dog. And so it's leading us in interesting places. One of the things we realized immediately is that nobody's heard of most of these microbes, and so we've actually contracted writers to write about these different species and lineages so that when we tell people what they have, they know something about what it is. This happens to be a species that only lives in hot water heaters. This is a species that lives hot water heaters and hot springs, but the lineage in hot water heaters seems unique, has never been found anywhere else. But we want to move on from this and understand the broader context. And so is this a story about Raleigh? What happens if we scale out? What happens if we try to understand houses in general? Do we spread across this space with composition? And again, we're in this sort of exploratory phase, and it makes it incredibly fun. Although I'm also cognizant of part of what we're trying to figure out is we're trying to understand what influences which species are in our houses so we can control which species are present, and then also how they influence us. And so although we're really in this exploratory phase, those are ultimate goals as we try to understand these phenomena. And so one of the places we've gone to sort of get some more context is we're now working with the Himba in Namibia, who are pastureless, and they live in houses that are not our traditional houses, but that are much more like traditional houses. And one of the interesting things for me is to understand how unusual are the microbes in our houses. Is this something we've been dealing with for 10,000 years, 100,000 years, 3 million years, or are they quite different? And so in working with the Himba, we've actually found that we can identify many of the same habitats. And one of the predictions is the Himba houses will be much more diverse, This goes to the hygiene hypothesis literature, but also that they would have fewer habitats because everything is kind of together. So here you can see one of these houses. I think this is a cigarette pack on the top, which is to indicate these are houses more like the traditional houses. They're not traditional houses. And so right away, what we find so far, and we're just starting to look at these data, is that Hemba houses are very different compositionally than houses in Raleigh. And this is actually more broadly across the US here. But what's interesting is we actually recover similar structure. And so you can see outer door surfaces are kind of going in this direction. Pillows are kind of coming in this direction with skin associates. And so there's the same kind of structure, but it's condensed. And so there's something really fundamental about how our houses are organized ecologically. The Hemba houses for all the habitats are more diverse, the number of kinds of species, which is interesting. And we're looking into this in more detail and trying to get more of this context. We're also starting to look in chimp and gorilla nests, because it's been argued for a while for invertebrates that many of the species in our houses actually come from nests. But nobody's ever sampled what lives in a chimp or a gorilla nest. And so we found this chimp researcher who's been studying chimp nests. She actually sleeps in them to understand how they make them comfortable or not, which actually makes me want to swab her and see if she's picking up chimp DNA or chimp microbe. But anyway, so we're moving in that direction. But we also want to put this back in this context of what's going on in Utah, what's going on in North America. How do our decisions affect these things? How much does climate matter, socioeconomics? And to try to think about a place like this, which on the one hand, this is so different from a Hemba house that they don't seem to belong in the same graph. On the other hand, we're sort of building many, many Hemba houses. And so thinking about how this all comes together is really fascinating. And thinking about how many species are in a system like this, I think we don't have a clue. One of the interesting pieces of context as we go about this work is that people start to think more and more about the composition of microbes outside our houses and how it impacts our daily life and health. This is a guy named Ilka Hansky. He's an evolutionary biologist. He's one of my tribe, worked on dung beetles for most of his life. He's now teamed up with epidemiologists in a small town in Finland, and they've looked at adolescents in houses around that town to look at which species live in their backyard, mostly of plants, which species are on their skin, and then how great their propensity to allergies. And what Hansky has found is that the adolescents who live in houses with more kinds of native plants in their backyards have very different microbes on their skin, and in turn are at a much reduced risk of allergy. And so there's an interesting piece. It's a direct link between what's going on outside and in the house and on our skin and in our health. But it's for one town in Finland. Maybe we're not all Finnish. But the other interesting thing, going back to our results for dogs, is that there's a body of work focused on Detroit showing that pregnant mothers who are pregnant in houses with dogs have children who are at a reduced risk of autoimmune disorders and allergies. It's been speculated that that's because the dog microbes are in some way priming the mother's immune system or the fetus's immune system. And so what becomes interesting, and this is speculation at this point, that's when you know you're wiggling too much, is that in part what the dogs are doing is connecting us with outdoor biodiversity, and we've reduced the biodiversity in our houses so dramatically that what comes in on a dog's foot is enough to suffice in some ways to have our immune systems make sense. And so this is the kind of direction we're going. And we're going it this way with these samples. So we now have 1,300 houses we've sampled across North America. And this is the same kind of public science. People sample their own houses. They put data loggers in their own houses. And we can do experiments in their houses. These are individuals that are part of the Personal Genome Project. And so we also have genomic and microbiome data about these people, as well as their health histories. And so at this context, we want to get at these links between landscape and house and body and health in super interesting ways. But the question becomes, in a medical context, in a personal health context, if this is all we know at this point in this big picture way, what do we do? And I'll argue that historically there was one answer to dealing with ignorance, to dealing with lots of species, and that was to kill stuff. Historically, we got really, really good at killing stuff. And many of us are alive as a function of that. Killing predators at one point saved our children. Killing pests saves our food. Killing dangerous bacteria save many, many of our lives. And so we still need this. But what we also need is to think about ways to also favor beneficial species. And so we have a stick. We've been really good historically at a stick. How do we think about carrots? And one of the reasons to think about this is if we only use the stick, what we get are pesticide-resistant bed bugs, rats that evolve in response to rat poison, methicillin-resistant bacteria. And so we need to think about carrots. But the problem is this ignorance. The problem is we know so little about the species around us. The problem is there are new phyla of life living in your armpits. And so how do we manage that? I think it's a real issue. But interestingly, it's actually one we've been dealing with for longer than we tend to think. And so beginning in the 1950s, Heinz Eichenwald did experiments where he was actually choosing beneficial staph species, Staphylococcus species, and inoculating newborns in hospitals to chase pathogen staph out of those hospitals. It proved to be very, very effective, and they were actually able to chase pathogenic staph out of 6 different hospitals. And so we've been thinking about this kind of thing for a long time. In some ways, the beetles have been thinking about it for longer, not consciously, but in terms of their evolutionary responses. Because while on the one hand we're thinking about how do you favor one species, the beetles actually have all sorts of adaptations for favoring some sweet species, disfavoring others, and cultivating in a whole suite of microbes that they need. The ants do too. This is a cast of an ant nest in which the structure of the ant nest is built both to make CO2 and oxygen move in useful ways, but also to allow beneficial microbes to grow and to rid the nest of not beneficial microbes. These ants have much more control of the microbes in their nest than we have of the microbes in our homes. And so we need to think about how we move forward, but with this problem in mind of ignorance. And so we've just finished a project on armpit biodiversity in which we're looking at armpits of people who do and don't use antiperspirant. It turns out they're very, very different. That the antiperspirant users have many, many more spirochetes. We don't know what that means yet, but it's very predictable. And many of these spirochete lineages are pathogens. So that's interesting. But the other thing is that most of the, aside from the 2 most common lineages in armpits, most of the other common ones are from families or phyla that don't have names. And so how do we deal with that, with this really incredible ignorance? It's hard to choose a good armpit project picture. I think one of the things that's interesting in this regard is we can predict some features of our microbiome. Ah, it didn't work. There's a video here. So there's a video here that should show a bunch of lines of individual people's microbial composition through time. And what we've recently been able to show is that we can predict from a sample of a person at one point how variable their microbiome will be through time. And so some people seem to be characterized by very variable microbiomes. And that's true for their guts and for skin samples and for tongue. And so there's something characteristic of these variable microbiomes which we tend to think of as being more problematic in terms of health. Those people also tend to have a low diversity to start with. And so what we might be able to do is to start to think about not of just individual species, but can we identify characteristics of healthy biomes and sick ones even before we've identified which species are really important. Oh, there we go. So those are individual people and their microbiomes changing through time. And what you can see is the different colors are different habitats. The habitats can overlap. And so some people's hands become fecal for a little bit. Some people's mouths become more fecal. But people have a characteristic way in which they change through time. Oops. And so what we're thinking is that maybe we can link up what we know about the diversity of microbes and the variability to identify aspects of healthy and sick guts. And so here's the diversity of gut microbes. This is the variability of gut microbes. These are real data. And so what we think is that these tend to be healthier guts. These tend to be people that are more at risk for inflammatory bowel disease, Crohn's, and other inflammatory problems. This is very early stages, but it would be an interesting way forward. Interestingly, one of the ways to deal with this, and Chad gave a talk about this earlier, is to think about, well, can we do things like fecal transplants, where we take a good microbiome and transplant it where we have a bad one? I think this is a really interesting way forward. I think a key aspect will be figuring out, how do we measure what a good microbiome is? Interestingly, the termites know how to do this. So termites actually have to do fecal transplants. That's how they get their microbes. And they have all sorts of evolutionary filters for filtering good microbes when they do it. And so we should think about, how do we do this? How do we learn from the termites that have been doing fecal transplants for 100 million years? As sort of a final piece to the story, how many of you have your appendix out in this room? How many of you take appendixes out? It's an interesting crowd for this. Right, so the old story about what the appendix does is that the appendix was a vestigial organ. Or maybe it had some lymphatic role, but it really wasn't studied for a long, long time. This guy, who's a colleague of mine down the road at Duke Medical Center, began arguing a few years ago that the role of the appendix was actually to store good bacteria as a kind of nature reserve, so that when you got cholera, when you got some really severe infection, your gut could be recolonized. It was like an autofecal transplant. And so he argued this in a paper, I guess now 8 years ago now, and I sort of expected everybody to email him and tell him he was crazy. And he is a little bit crazy. He's this backwoods hillbilly from Arkansas that spent a while in the seminary. Nobody did. And then an evolutionary paper came out arguing that if you look at human appendixes, they're actually more derived. They're more consistent in size and larger than what we reconstruct for our ancestors. And so it looks like we actually have bigger, more elaborate appendixes than our ancestors probably did. And so those two pieces came together in an interesting way to suggest, well, maybe Parker was onto something, but it still was kind of unclear. And then a study came out last year which compared the fate of individuals with C. diff who did and did not have their appendix. And what Parker would predict is that if you had a case of recurrent C. diff, that if you had your appendix, it should be easier to recover. In fact, what this study found was that those individuals with their appendix were threefold more likely to recover well from recurrent C. diff. And so this isn't a nail in the coffin, theoretically, but it's pretty darn interesting. And so what it suggests is that while we're fumbling to figure out how to deal with all these species, the elements of our body have known how to do it evolutionarily for a long time. And so this is where I think there are interesting evolutionary lessons. I think there's also an interesting lesson, just for a little closure here, in the reality that it's possible that our dogs, that used to be predators, that used to influence us in our fight and flight and things like our goosebumps, might actually be serving as a connection to other species in a world in which we're so poorly connected to wild nature that the dirt on a dog's feet is enough. And so I think that there are a lot of lessons here to be learned from evolutionary biology. And I think the big lesson, though, is that we've spent thousands of years figuring out how to kill bad species. And now we need also to figure out how to favor good species. And the key thing is figuring out either who they are or how to characterize a sick assemblage of these species. And I think it's a really exciting time. As an evolutionary biologist, it's super fascinating because I can be like Lewis and Clark and go boldly in places nobody knows, and we find fun things all the time. From a medical perspective, that's scary, right? We would hope that we're not still so ignorant about our own bodies that people can discover new species in your colon just by looking. So what do you do now? I hope some people buy the book, but if you don't buy the book, you can come help us at your wildlife to study the species that live on us. You can volunteer your body, your house, your neighbor. Actually, IRB does not allow us to put neighbor volunteers. We study all kinds of things in this context. We do all of it publicly. All the data goes back. All of our data is actually available before it's published. And so if you want to look at it before we do, you can. And so I'd love for people to sign up and participate. I'll conclude here with a bit of a mystery and a query, which is that no one, as far as I know, has actually studied the full microbiome of doctors, nurses, and surgeons' hands. So we've looked at pathogens, we looked at individual species, but as far as I know, nobody knows whether or not people who deal with patients all the time and scrub all the time have very, very different microbes in their hands. If anybody wants to look, give me a call. My prediction is that the faunas are super different. And have very different functions. But we don't know, and I think that's a pretty amazing thing that you might think about as you scrub. The last thing is that the new work I'm doing in terms of writing is about the heart, and so if you have great heart stories, stories about your own heart, other people's hearts, heart discovery, let me know. I'm always on the lookout for good stories. And so with that, I will thank you. I hope there's some good discussion, and thanks again for putting up with the off-color conversation during lunch.